This is Building Tomorrow. I'm your host, Paul Matsko, and with me in the studio are Matthew Feeney, Cato's Director of Emerging Tech, and Caleb Watney from the R Street Institute. Normally, I would kick off this show with a chipper. Building Tomorrow is a podcast that promotes freedom and prosperity and happiness, but our topic today is a reminder that as much as tech can be designed for good and for benefiting humankind, it can also be used for evil. And we're going to be talking about the live stream and the reaction to the live stream of the Christchurch shootings. When the man filled with hatred walked into two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, and killed 50 worshipers. We're not going to be talking about the shooting itself, but I would like to take a brief moment to commemorate the brave and loving people who were the victims of that shooting. People like Daoud Nabi, who greeted the shooter who murdered him. He greeted his murderer with "Hello, brother," at the door. Or Naeem Rashid, who charged the shooter, forcing him to take time to reload and recover himself, and saved lives as a result. And Hosniara Parvin, who sacrificed her life trying to save her disabled husband's life. These are the heroes of the shooting. They are people who, faced with the most horrific situation, responded with love and with compassion, even as they were victims of a tragedy. And so from those of us here at Building Tomorrow, we say to them and to their families, assalamu alaikum, and our thoughts are with you. This is the first mass shooting in which we had a live stream of the event, as far as I understand. I don't think there's been a mass shooting to this point that's been live streamed. We've had individual smaller scale shootings that have been caught on tape, but not like a GoPro style mass shooting of this scale. And it's not going to be the last, right? This is going to become a phenomenon of people live streaming their terrorist attacks. It's the world we live in. So I think going forward, we have to realize this is the beginning of a trend, not a one-off black swan kind of event. And I think first we should talk about, okay, how did tech companies respond? This was live streamed on Facebook, I believe. How did Facebook, YouTube, Google, how did the big tech companies respond to this, first of all, being live streamed, and then later on uploads of this video going up on platforms?
Well, you're right to point out that it was live streamed on Facebook, and I think it is difficult to pin down exactly how many people have seen this footage. I mean, Facebook said that about, I think, 200 people were watching it live, and a total of 4,000 people maybe have seen it on the Facebook platform. But the so-called like big tech companies, right, were really in a scramble to take this thing down. And those are the usual. So Facebook, obviously, YouTube made a big effort. But they're in the unenvious position, though, of playing whack-a-mole, really. This thing proliferated across the internet, and it's now up there forever. Anyone who is curious enough can find it. And I think it really called into question how these platforms moderate their content. And if I remember reading yesterday that YouTube actually just ditched human moderators and thought, look, we'll just throw machine learning at this and there'll be false positives, but that's, you know, a bullet we're willing to bite in the midst of this, you know, tragic historic event. I think it's worth keeping in mind, of course, that this the Christchurch shootings happened very quickly. I think it was all over in about 40 minutes. And it takes time to figure out not just where's this video, who's posting it, is it authentic, is this a movie. It can take some time, and I think AI certainly has a role to play in this, but there's the worry of false positives and false negatives as well.
So when we talk about machine learning, I think we're talking about you identify some sections of the clip, and then it trawls through everything that's being live streamed or posted and tries to make a match. Is it essentially using like a Google image search, looking for like images, but for video, and then it pulls it if it looks too similar?
Well, they can use what's called digital hashes, like these fingerprints, right? And they're very useful, I think, for copyright, right? So the people want to upload a movie onto YouTube, that will quickly get flagged automatically. But as the technology improves, there will be other kinds of detection, right, that they'll use. But this kind of thing's difficult because audio of gunfire is in very legitimate footage, as is this really disturbing first-person shooter perspective. You know, people who are hunters and hobbyists are people who like to talk about guns. And I think that's where people worry about potential overkill when it comes to the use of machine learning in content moderation. But I'm optimistic that as the technology improves, this will get better. I just don't think it was up to scratch that a lot of people would have liked last week in New Zealand.
I think it's also worth just taking a moment and realizing that if there are people on the internet who want to watch something, they're going to find a way to watch something,
right?
Regardless of whether that be on the big platforms or on, you know, all these new distributed file sharing websites that, you know, there really is not any one central authority that you can ask to take it down or censor it. Yeah, I mean, we've been trying to stop the scourge of child pornography and, you know, revenge porn and all these things for decades and decades. And it's a fight that we're constantly engaged in, and it's worth doing that. But yeah, it's worth having like a certain level of expectation, realizing we're not going to be able to fully stop it.
Yeah. Well, and there's the I was reminded of there is a do something kind of impulse here, which is something horrible happened. We feel bad and anxious about that, and rightly so, right? Mm-hmm. But that impulse can quickly lean to, well, as long as we do something, these feelings will go away and we can move on. And the sad part of that is that means we actually don't do things that will be more effective in actually addressing problems of terrorism and of radicalization, et cetera, as long as we just make a gesture. And the gesture is, we're going to feel good if we try to shut down live streaming, if we try to, you know, get back at digital platforms that broadcast this video.
Well, I think it goes further than that, though, at least given different legal system to ours, right? So New Zealand had an actual ban on the sharing of the video, right? And but not as best as I can understand, and I'm by no means an expert on New Zealand law, but it seemed to me there wasn't a similar prohibition on the so-called manifesto of this shooter, that there was a particular emphasis on the video, which, you know, is a horrible piece of media, no doubt. But if you're worried about the proliferation of the ideas and of whatever motivated the shooter, it seems to me that the manifesto should at least be on par as far as concern goes, right? But New Zealand has a totally different legal. But as Kayla mentioned, in the 21st century, it's sort of a fruitless tool to be using, given that anyone with a little bit of know-how in New Zealand will easily be able to access this thing.
Yeah, I made a note here. New Zealand has a chief censor, WTF New Zealand, like who has an official person whose title is chief censor.
China does.
Yeah, right, China, New Zealand. I mean, there are places with that. And actually, to quote said chief censor, a Mr. Shanks, every New Zealander should now be clear that this clip is an illegal, harmful, and reprehensible record created to promote a terrorist cause. If you have a record of it, you must delete it. If you see it, you should report it. Possessing or distributing it is illegal and only supports a criminal agenda.
But this really raises the obvious question. What does it mean to control? What's the quote to control or own or is, if you have a record of it. So I don't actually really know what that means. I suppose if you have it on a USB stick or something, you could make an argument. But if you see it on Twitter, you don't own it if someone's posted it, right?
All these new like distributed platforms where kind of by taking part in the platform itself, you're kind of helping host all videos that are on there. Mm-hmm. But if you have like no knowledge of the fact that you're hosting it, like is motivation a key part of like whether or not you fall under this law?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, the video has been circulated on, was it File Planet?
The Interplanet, which is something similar to I think what Caleb.
Yeah, I think it's distributed, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I mean everyone, it's a file sharing kind of system, right? Mm-hmm. And so everyone on there controls a piece of some chunk of the content. So that just technically criminalized anyone who's, you know, a big chunk of people who are on Interplanetary on the network in New Zealand now are criminals according to the chief censor of New Zealand. So it is a measure aimed at. It's almost aimed at its early internet days, and the internet has evolved to the point where that just is odd, right? That's an odd way of thinking about.
But it goes back to the instinct you highlighted earlier, which is if you're, you know, in law enforcement in New Zealand on the day this happens, you've got to say something about it, and you've got to do something about it. And I think it's probably worth mentioning the actual, you know, the body of legislation that actually governs a lot of like content on these platforms, right? Because people might be thinking whether these platforms are under like a legal obligation to take stuff like this down, or whether it's a PR move, and that's certainly something lawmakers in this country have been talking about. There's, you know, what people refer to as Section 230, right, which protects platforms like Facebook from liability for content that users upload, basically, and which I don't think it's an exaggeration to say is, you know, a pretty key piece of legislation to allow the internet as we know it to exist. But Senator Mark Warner, in the wake of the Pittsburgh shooting, right, mentioned that he was really concerned about the immunity that platforms have when it comes to extremist content. And I think what happened in Christchurch will only give lawmakers another opportunity to potentially whittle away a really important piece of legislation.
Yeah, and I think we can draw a distinction between, you know, private sector censorship and public censorship, where,
of
like,
course,
I'm fully supportive of the rights of any media outlet to decide not to air the video. In fact, I kind of prefer they didn't. But there's a distinction between that and the government, whether a chief censor or directly banning this content, or the U.S. government weakening internet protections like Section 230 in order as a kind of backdoor attempt to get rid of content like this, or to disincentivize people posting content like this. I mean, either direction is – it's censorship. It's a first – I mean, in the U.S. we have the First Amendment. I don't know if New Zealand has a comparable Bill of Rights. But in here, you know, speech is protected, including reprehensible speech, which this clearly qualifies as. And so – if you weaken, I mean, it's possible too that in playing this game of whack-a-mole, you could undermine the kind of very pillars of the internet itself. Like without Section 230, every time a troll posts a death threat on Twitter and Twitter doesn't immediately take it down, they could face a lawsuit.
Right. And it's, I think, particularly disturbing because there are the two big discussions you see about this, right? There's this 230 reform, but this happening at the same time that lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are talking about antitrust when it comes to what they call big tech, right? And the idea that smaller companies would somehow handle this sort of thing in a better way confuses me.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. I want to touch on that second point, but first I want to take a step back and realize that this is a broader conversation than even just internet platforms and like Section 230. This is like, how do we have discussions that aren't like directly moderated, you know, by each comment to comment? You've seen just recently a number of the big news media sites like the New York Times, Washington Post have shut down their comment sections that they used to have. And it's partially because they're running into this exact problem where they don't want to allow anyone to be able to post and then have that content potentially held against them, even just in a PR context, legally. But then trying to hire like human moderators to go through and check every single comment before it's posted is incredibly expensive and damaging to like the minds of the people who are having to moderate the vast, you know, wasteland of the of human imagination.
There's like all these like poor folks in like Bangladesh who have to or in centers around the world who have to like watch thousands of hours of everything from like child porn to whatever, so they can pull it off these platforms.
Yeah, no, it's awful. And so we're really kind of like at a crossroads about like, well, how do we value these various values, and do we want there to be space on the internet to have unmoderated discussions, and how public should those be, and should those be attached to, you know, reputable brand names?
Yeah. Well, and if you push them off the reputable brand names, I mean, I think, again, the whack-a-mole metaphor is fitting. If you push it off the major platforms, right, folks will find a way of organizing new platforms. And that can go even from, okay, if you take people off Tumblr or off, you know, social media platforms most people have heard of, they go to Reddit. If you take them off Reddit, they go to 4chan. If 4chan, if they feel oppressed by 4chan, they form 8chan. If 8chan gets shut down, they go, you know, there's –
there'll be 16chan.
There'll be 16chan, 32. I don't know if it's a square. Or eventually you could go to the black web, right? I mean, you can go dark web. It would be much harder. You know, it's harder to access. But for a really motivated radical community, I mean, people who are being radicalized in online forums, if you're determined enough, you can make it happen, right? And so the same thing true of conversations, you know, the Gab and the proliferation of new platforms for people to share ideas and converse online. So like you fundamentally, that's because of the structure of the internet, right? Like I don't know, short of shutting down the internet, if you can actually get rid of that.
Well, I think what you might see platforms respond to is just by going to more and more encrypted channels, because then they just don't have the ability to stop things, right? That's what you saw with WhatsApp. These videos were being shared over WhatsApp too. And while there was some criticism of that, there was certainly a lot less than there was of Facebook or Twitter or most of the major platforms, partially because like you can't tell WhatsApp to shut down the video because they just don't have the capability. And you know, Facebook's recent pivot to privacy, some people are speculating that, you know, they may try to get around some of these questions of moderation by just pushing encryption on everyone.
Well, which is problematic. If your goal is law and order and law enforcement, that's problematic, because now they can't help. You can't track this conversation, right? So if you force it underground or into encryption, which isn't technically underground, but if you force it below public notice, it makes it harder to track the criminals. I mean, we saw this with Sesta Fosta, with sex trafficking. And what you did was you didn't actually get rid of sex trafficking. You got rid of a lot of legal prostitution and personal ads on sites like Backpage.com. It shoved some prostitutes out into the streets in dangerous situations, but it's also pushed actual sex traffickers below the notice of law enforcement. It's made them harder for them to track sex trafficking through. It's backfiring, right? That kind of action can ultimately make it harder to get rid of criminal conduct and in this case, terrorist misconduct. So that's the perversity. I mean, so it's not only that the backlash won't work and might have ill consequences, i.e. breaking the internet. It's that in doing so, you can actually make the threat, the problem, worse in the end. Now, Caleb, you've looked a little bit at, I think, Elizabeth Warren's kind of how does this tie into Elizabeth Warren's plan for the big tech companies?
Yeah, well, as we were kind of talking about earlier, this definitely does fall into the category of, you know, we're mad about this, we want to do something about it. And perhaps that, you know, instinct to want to do something is understandable. But that also latches onto kind of unrelated topics that people are also mad about, you know. So you've seen, obviously, Elizabeth Warren, I think a week or two ago, brought up this proposal to break up big tech firms, specifically Google, Amazon, Facebook, and as she later clarified, oh, Apple as well.
Might as well.
And then with how broadly her rules around platforms are written, it may also include grocery stores or retail stores or anyone that kind of has like a platform that people can interact with and then also sell their own brand on top of. But you saw this being connected with the Christchurch shooting as well. People said, hey, look, here's another bad thing that the tech companies are doing. Here's further evidence that we should break them up. When there's not at all like a clear theory of harm about how, you know, the concentration of Facebook leads to this. And if anything, it seems like breaking up Facebook leading to more platforms and more decentralized platforms would actually make it way harder to actually stop the spread of this video. It would proliferate in a way that's way less possible to control.
So flesh that out. Why would dispersing the company make it harder to you know, take down live streams and videos? And
so obviously for people that want to find the video, they're going to find the video.
Right, right.
So the main thing is, how do you stop people that wouldn't have otherwise seen the video from just their normal scrolling from seeing it? And Facebook being one concentrated place, obviously there are other platforms, but if you were to break up Facebook, presumably there would be more platforms. Just having one censorship team being able to flag this video, stop it via their algorithms or the human moderators, and then try to prevent the spread of it from the rest of the Facebook platform is much easier than, you know, 20 different platforms, each with their own separate censorship teams trying to find it at the exact same time, stop it at the exact same time in coordination.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing is, if you were to break up Facebook, you might see more of the social media market share also shift to maybe decentralized platforms in which there is no person to control it in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, that's the give or take, right? Like you it'd be interesting too, I think, to put this in the historical context, and I'll put my historian hat on for a moment, because as soon as I heard about some of the proposals to like weaken Section 230 and just in general like legislative overreach as a response, I thought of the Video Nasties, as it was called, Video Nasties Panic in the UK in the 1980s. And a few themes. First of all, what we saw happen in the UK in the 80s was we saw folks who had a set of reasons to dislike a new technology or a new use of technology. seize on a moment of like kind of moral, ethical, cultural crisis and use that as an excuse to push their agenda. So they had other, you know, less noble, altruistic reasons for promoting kind of a moment of moral panic. So the Video Nasties in the 1980s, essentially what happens, VHS software. I mean, today it's dated, obviously. I guess the generation now might not have ever seen the VHS tape before. Maybe in a Goodwill still. You can pick up copies of, I don't know, True Lies or something. But this is radically – it's a radical challenge to the traditional Hollywood distribution model for movies, for film and television. Because now rather than having to go to a movie theater or watch something live on TV, you can pop in a blank copy of VHS and record it. And then give that to your friends if they miss the Showtime nighttime movie, or if they missed, you know, or you can get a copy in theory of a Hollywood blockbuster, duplicate it and circulate it around. So it's a real challenge to their business model. So they have their own self-interested reasons for being skeptical of the rise of home video VHS technology. Then what happens is there's this the media essentially promotes a panic about what these video nasties, which are snuff films, you know, videos of murders and the like, softcore pornography. But then in general, there's this whole genre of exploitation films, a lot of them from Italian directors, Cannibal Holocaust, I Spit on Your Grave, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, not by an Italian, but it was considered as one of a video nasty in the 1980s. So a lot of horror, new wave horror films. But the reason why they proliferated was because Hollywood refused to play along. They weren't releasing their movies on VHS because they were trying to resist the trend. But people have these in their homes. A quarter of Brits have a VHS, have a tape deck in their house by 1984. So they want there's a demand for tapes. And if Hollywood won't give them tapes, they'll find them in this kind of gray market of video nasties being circulated. So if you choke off supply because you're afraid of a challenge to your business model, you're going to get demand from somewhere. And so you get this proliferation of what are video nasties. The media hypes up the problem of this. Like, children are being exposed to these horrific, you know, snuff films and pornography and exploitation. Something must be done. They got to do something. And so as a result, Britain passes legislation. I think it's called the British Board of Film Censors is given the power to classify all movies. And if you possess an unclassified movie, it's a felony offense. So there are knock-on effects. So there's obviously suppression of speech going on there. It's probably a lost generation of indie filmmakers because you could not go and record a movie on $1,000 in the prayer and distribute it because you couldn't afford to classify something like that. But you have created a movie that's unclassified. It's illegal to do so in the UK. So my point being, there's this overreaction that is promoted by people with if you will, secular interests and exogenous interests. I mean, Hollywood wants this to happen because they don't want competition to their business model. So the same thing, in a sense, is happening, and they're taking advantage of a moment of moral panic to do so. And you can see the kind of the outlines of that right here. So you have folks with a pre-existing interest in breaking up and or even just generally punishing the tech companies, whether it's Elizabeth Warren or others, who have a whole range of secular exogenous interests about doing that to big tech. Along comes a moment of cultural crisis, a moment to mass shootings. And there's going to be more of these. This moment's only going to be amplified as we go forward, I suspect. And they're willing to seize on that as a justification for broad sweeping expansions of government oversight and authority. So I think there's a cautionary tale there.
I suppose this fits into this whole theme of overreaction makes me wonder about some kind of Streisand effect with these sort of things, right?
Oh,
that uh-huh. you I don't know how else to put it, but there's a chance that when you engage in this sort of stuff, you martyr these people in a way that this shooter has managed to prompt a massive overhaul of New Zealand's gun laws, has prompted the government to call out and say possession of this thing is illegal. And I think it probably behooves people to think about how much attention being paid to this kind of thing actually encourages it, right? Now, if you're a private company, there's a clear interest in you getting rid of it. I understand that. But I suppose this is more comment about public comment on it, right? Because I do worry that people like this get too much airtime.
Yeah, I mean, especially when I didn't read the full manifesto, but I read some summaries of it. And it seems like he was trying to promote kind of like a left-wing reaction to, you know, memes that he was going to bring up create a public fervor and then hopefully crack down in a way that sort of, I think from his goal, he's like probably a right-wing accelerationist, you know, if you can lead to the breakdown of the state, cause like civil war or something. And so, yeah, in some ways, the backlash on the huge media presence that his video and the manifesto created, played partially into his motivations.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a literature that ties quantity of broadcast coverage to a elevated risk of like copycat shootings in the weeks after a mass shooting. So, but as far as I know, like it's still a new question to apply that to like, I've never seen that applied to, I mean, it's just too new, this idea of live streaming or shared video online, if that contributes in any way. So we don't know, but that's a separate question, right? Like what we know is that the media just paying attention to mass shootings, hyping, you know, talking about them constantly 24/7 leads to an uptick in follow-up mass shootings. And you can see that in the statistical trend charts. Basically with the, once you get cable news networks in the 1990s, it's not even just the prevalence of mass shootings, but also their deadliness escalates because it becomes – so more people are shot per shooting rather than many more shootings per se, because the copycat killers are essentially competing for who can get the biggest body count so that they can get their day in the, their 15 minutes of fame on broadcast news coverage. But that's a pre-internet problem. That's not a digital era problem per se. That's a broadcast problem that we already know about and – you know, I don't know if we're doing all that much to effectively address it. And in general, I think like when you look at the manifesto, there's a ton of what they, you know, it's the internet term is shitposting, right? So he's saying, you know, go watch PewDiePie, one of the most popular YouTube or Twitch streamers, or no, YouTubers, I guess he's primarily a YouTuber. He shouts out Candace Owens as an inspiration. That's not real. Like he's doing that just to leave red herrings. Credits Spyro the Dragon 3 video game for inspiring. That's, again, he's just pumping out fake content to lead people down rabbit trails and to get people to overreact to those references and miss what he's actually, I mean, the core message. And the core message, I mean, there are, again, if you're concerned about online radicalization, you're missing the fact that his actual inspirations that he returns to repeatedly in the stuff he etched on his gun stocks and on his ammunition magazines, they put in the manifesto, it's older stuff. It's traditional white supremacist inspirations. It's stuff like he references Oswald Mosley, the famous UK fascist, interwar fascist, David Lane's 14 words about, you know, white genocide, the Turner Diaries, authored by William Pierce in the 70s, which is a highly influential work of white supremacist fiction. Those are the things that inspired Timothy McVeigh. I mean, right, like pre-internet era stuff. So in a sense, his inspiration model is very old school. It's pre-digital. Like there's continuity there. So I think a lot of the conversation is, do these online platforms like 4chan, Reddit, et cetera, do they promote and fuel radicalization? Well, sure, but so too do they. There were corollaries for that prior to the internet, and there will be corollaries no matter what we do going forward in the future. I mean, one of my takeaways was I was impressed with how quick and adept the platforms were in taking down the video. I mean, the success rate was, I think for YouTube, they pulled down like 90% or close to of the uploaded videos just basically immediately. Real briefly, going forward, where do we think the tech can evolve if we let it evolve to more efficiently and more quickly address the problem of live streaming mass shootings?
Yeah, it's a hard question because, I mean, as we touched on a little bit earlier in the conversation, you know, you might try to recognize certain sounds like gunfire or screaming, but then there's also lots of like movies or, you know, video game clips where you hear those same sounds. You could try going for, you know, particular images. But again, I mean, he was almost trying to emulate like a video game in some capacity. And I think, you, as you pointed out, that seems more like correlation rather than causation. But it does make the problem of trying to detect it earlier on using algorithms more difficult. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how to do this. I mean, as you did point out, YouTube, Facebook, they had some success in trying to take these down or in flagging them via their algorithms. But it's hard. Yeah, I'm not sure if there's a good answer to it. And obviously, I'm not, you know, the engineers trying to solve this problem. I'd be curious to get one of them in here and talk about what methods they're working on that might have a better success rate with this.
Yeah, what is frustrating is the number of politicians around the world who have a very nerd harder like attitude towards this, that you should just throw computer science talent at this. And I know Senator Blumenthal described the platform response to this as an abject failure, which I think is very harsh.
That is a little harsh.
Given that they seem to have made a really good faith effort to take this down, but to describe what at least I've read about on the platforms as an abject failure, I think fails to recognize the difficulty of the problem and also how easy it is for this stuff to proliferate. And unfortunately for Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, if they can never reach 100%, it won't be good enough for some people. I don't see them getting to 100% anytime soon.
It reminds me a little bit of the encryption debate. You know, like, why can't you just create a secret backdoor that only the police or national security forces can use?
Right.
Just nerd harder, do it. You know, you have the tech, you have magic.
Magic tech dust, sprinkle over. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think, too, that while it might not be the most satisfying emotional reaction, if we just end with, there should be an element of keep calm and carry on, that like there is a problem here, but if we panic about it, we can make things worse. We can go down unproductive avenues in pursuing governmental solutions. So we should take a collective breath before we propose legislation in the immediate wake of a mass shooting like this. That's all we have time for today. Thank you, Caleb, for coming on. And for the rest of our listeners, be well. Thanks for listening. Building Tomorrow is produced by Tess Terrible. If you enjoy Building Tomorrow, please subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, find us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.